This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Senate Judiciary Committee hearings on Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas begin tomorrow. My guest Anthony Lewis won a 1963 Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of the Supreme Court in the New York Times. Now Lewis is a columnist for the Times. Today he writes, "What the president and his right-wing supporters want, and what they are getting, is a Supreme Court that will increase presidential power and carry out the political agenda of the right." We'll talk with Lewis about the Thomas nomination a little later. Lewis has written a new book about one of the most important First Amendment decisions in Supreme Court history, Sullivan versus the New York Times. In 1960, a civil rights group placed an ad in the Times to generate support for Martin Luther King and the movement. The ad described a wave of terror launched against students engaged in nonviolent demonstrations, and described how segregationists were trying to remove King from his leadership position through attacks and intimidation. Although no one was singled out by name, the Montgomery, Alabama City Commissioner, L.B. Sullivan, who also headed the police, sued the Times for libel. The Times lost in Alabama, but won in the Supreme Court appeal. Justice William Brennan wrote the opinion of the court.
First of all, Justice Brennan's opinion made clear that libel, that calling something libel, did not exempt it from examination under the First Amendment. If the effect of a libel suit was to chill the freedom of political speech, the freedom to criticize public officials, then it was to be treated the same way as if you were prosecuted for making a speech on a soapbox in Columbus Circle. Well, people don't do that anymore. It's an old-fashioned metaphor. But prosecuted for making a speech, a libel suit, Justice Brennan said, can be more intimidating than a criminal prosecution. A $500,000 judgment against you in a libel suit is much larger than the fine in, in most criminal cases. And so that was the first thing. Libel was no longer an obstruction to application of the First Amendment. Now, secondly, he laid down a rule for libel cases brought by public officials. That is to say, a public official could not win libel damages unless he or she proved that a false statement had been made about the official, published about the official, with knowledge that it was false or in reckless disregard of its truth or falsity, which was later interpreted to mean knowledge of that it was false or being on notice that it was probably false. That is really deliberate lying, or an editor who publishes a story about a politician even though he's been told, "Listen, Joe, you know that story you're going to run? I can tell you it's really false. You shouldn't go with it," and he prints it anyway. That kind of story, an official can win libel damages, but not for an inadvertent error, not for a mistake of the ordinary kind that newspapers make all the time.
Brennan's decision is really beautifully written. I was wondering if there was any of it you'd like to read or quote from to give a sense of a specific passage that means a lot to you as a journalist and as a student of the Supreme Court.
The most famous passage in the opinion, Justice Brennan's statement, "We consider this case against the background of a profound national commitment to the principle that debate on public issues should be uninhibited, robust, and wide open, and that it may well include vehement, caustic, and sometimes unpleasantly sharp attacks on government and public officials." Now, what makes that passage so meaningful to me is that while Justice Brennan could and did find passages in Supreme Court opinions here and there on which he could base that statement, by and large, that had not been true through most of American history, because right up until, the 1930s, and only sporadically then, the Supreme Court had shown very little regard for the idea of freedom of speech or freedom of the press. Through most of our history, the court had given the state, the United States government, state governments, very great power to suppress speech that governments regarded with disdain or that was critical of officials. I mean, I'll give you an example, rather shocking by our standards today. During World War I, Eugene Debs, the great socialist leader, 5 times candidate for president, made a speech in Canton, Ohio, in which he, almost in passing, it was not the subject of the speech, said he had been and visited 2 men who had been imprisoned for counseling draft evasion, and he admired their courage. for that statement, Debs was prosecuted under the Espionage Act, which made it a crime to interfere with recruitment for the armed forces, convicted and sentenced to 10 years in prison, and the Supreme Court unanimously affirmed that conviction.
If you're just joining us, my guest is New York Times columnist Anthony Lewis, and he's a former Supreme Court reporter at the Times. His work covering the court won him a Pulitzer Prize. His new book is called Make No Law, and it's about a Supreme Court ruling that was one of the most important First Amendment decisions of our time. It was the Sullivan versus the New York Times case. As you've pointed out, the Supreme Court is a reflection of who the recent presidents have been and what their choices have been. Now that a majority of the court will be reflecting conservative views, I'm wondering, is this the first time in your adult life that you'll be watching a conservative majority rule in the Supreme Court?
Well, I'd have to say we've been watching it for quite a few years now.
Yeah, well, true.
In fact, but before that, it might depend on adulthood. You have to realize something. I mean, the short answer to your question is, in rough terms, yes. But lest we become too, sort of cataclysmic about that, through most of American history, the Supreme Court was a very conservative institution. It began to change only in 1937 with the first Roosevelt appointment, the appointment of Hugo Black to replace Willis Van Devanter, one of the nine old men on the Supreme Court. It was only then that the court began to focus more on what we regard as libertarian values, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, instead of the old court's concern with protecting property and its relative disregard of free speech and other protections of the Bill of Rights.
The Clarence Thomas hearings are about to begin. If you were participating in those hearings, what questions would you want to ask him, and why would you choose those questions?
You put me in a difficult position with that, because I know what questions I want to ask, and yet I have some doubts about whether I would rightfully force an answer. Of course, I'm very interested to know how Judge Thomas feels about the First Amendment, about, shall we say, let's take a recent case, the flag-burning decisions, two decisions by votes of 5-4, holding that burning the flag in a political protest was a form of expression protected by the First Amendment. 5-4 decisions, opinions by Justice Brennan, who has since retired. How do you feel about those decisions, Judge Thomas? Or, what's on everybody's mind, abortion. How would you vote on Roe against Wade if and when, and it's going to be when, that issue comes before the court for reconsideration, and so on? I think those are very important questions, and yet, for historical reasons, I feel reluctant to press any nominee to the court to answer explicit questions on how he or she would vote on a particular issue.
Why?
Because I think that's giving, in a sense, a promise to the United States Senate on how you will vote. And I think it would compromise the oath of office that Supreme Court justices and other judges take, which is to the Constitution and not to the Senate. When, for example, Justice Brennan, we're speaking of him with the reverence he deserves as the author of the opinion in the Sullivan case and many other important libertarian decisions. When he was appointed to the court, Senator Joe McCarthy quizzed him, tried to get him to promise how he would vote on A or B or C. And Justice Brennan declined to say how he would vote on A or B or C. I think he rightly declined. He didn't want to give any hostages to fortune to Joe McCarthy.
I'm wondering if you were in the position where you could participate in this decision, whether you would vote to confirm Clarence Thomas, knowing what you know now. And, of course, there's a lot more you'd know by the time the hearings are over.
I'm going to play United States Senator and decline. Not something.
Well, diplomacy at work here.
No, it's not diplomacy. I assure you that nothing is farther from my mind than wanting to be a senator. But that would be really hell. But no, I think it's fair and right to see what happens at the hearings. I really don't know enough. I'd like to know what he says at the hearings. At this point, I will tell you what my views are. Mm-hmm. I haven't written them, so maybe I should wait and write my column. But at this point, I'm inclined to say that he is not by my standards, the kind of person who ought to be appointed to the Supreme Court. And I'm not talking now about his views on particular issues, but on his general qualifications. He is not one of the eminent lawyers or judges of the country who naturally would fall into that group of people, I think. As a president, if I were a president, I would want to appoint a learned hand, a Bill Brennan, to that court. I'd want to be remembered as the man. Let's take an example in history. When Herbert Hoover was president of the United States, in a time when he wasn't a very popular president, when the Democrats were moving in and he was a conservative Republican president, 1932, he appointed Benjamin Cardozo to the Supreme Court, a very eminent, revered judge of the highest court of New York. And he did so more or less because Cardozo was the lawyer that the legal profession and philosophers and scholars thought was the man best qualified to sit on the Supreme Court. I mean, in my heart of hearts, I wish presidents would make appointments to the Supreme Court on that kind of basis. Mostly they don't, I have to admit.
Why haven't you written about your opinions of the Clarence Thomas nomination to the Supreme Court? I mean, in your New York Times column, you write about just about everything, and as a former Supreme Court reporter, one would think you'd be one of the first persons out of the gate to be writing about this.
I began today to write about the court and where it stands and what I think it needs by way of a new member. And on that background, I will write about Judge Thomas as the hearings progress, and that's what I expect to do.
So, but still, I'm curious about why you've held back and really discussing the man.
I want to have something to say. I mean, maybe I'm making this sound more portentous than it is. When he was first nominated, I felt it was inappropriate to rush into a horseback comment on him. Everybody was sort of shooting off comments, and I thought it was better to reflect a bit, wait and see what turned up by way of his written work and what I've read all that during the summer. Then, just about at the time when I might have started writing about Judge Thomas, some other events of mild interest occurred over in the Soviet Union, so that rather monopolized my mind and my writing for some time. And now the hearings are beginning, and I've always thought that I would want to start talking about the Supreme Court and its current state, and on that premise, talk about the Thomas nomination.
I'm wondering if the issue of race, Clarence Thomas being African-American, if that complicates discussion for you of his nomination.
I think it does. It's a very good question. I think it actually does for everybody. I was a great admirer of Thurgood Marshall, and when he retired, I wrote and thought about him as somebody who had made a tremendous difference in this country as a lawyer and as a judge, starting a process that, while it has hardly made this a a race-free country, a country free of racial prejudice or race consciousness or the racial problem, has at least made us a country where the state does not cast its weight against people because of the color of their skin, and that's an immense difference. That's what the Brown case, Brown against Board of Education, and the other decisions and the legislation passed by Congress has done. I naturally feel that Judge Thomas has come along as the beneficiary of all that Thurgood Marshall did, and yet seems in a sense, unconcerned about that. But I want to tell you, I don't think that his views on affirmative action should be the determinant of the vote on confirmation of his nomination. I would myself, I think, be concerned about other issues facing the Supreme Court, ones I've mentioned earlier, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, privacy, abortion, the rights of defendants on trial for their lives or their liberty, to the protections of the those portions of the Bill of Rights that protect criminal defendants from, shall we say, coerced confessions, illegal search and seizure, bad representation, inadequate representation by counsel, those protections, I think, are the things that will mostly make up my mind about Judge Thomas.
New York Times columnist Anthony Lewis is my guest. He's written a new book called Make No Law, The Sullivan Case and the First Amendment. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, New York Times columnist Anthony Lewis is my guest. He used to cover the Supreme Court for the Times. He's also the author of the new book, Make No Law, The Sullivan Case and the First Amendment. What are some of the decisions that you think will be reviewed by the Supreme Court in the near future and changed now that it's a conservative court? Decisions that were made during the Warren and Berger courts.
Well, I have to tell you that in one decision last term, we were all put on notice that virtually anything that was decided by a vote of 5-4 is up for grabs. Chief Justice Rehnquist said in overruling an earlier decision on the Bill of Rights that, after all, that decision was decided by a vote of 5-4 with, I've forgotten what his adjective was, a strongly felt dissent, something like that. Well, since most 5-4 decisions produce strongly felt dissents, that tells us that any close decision of that character is now up for grabs, and a lot of them were of that nature. So you may write your own list. But I've mentioned the flag-burning decisions, abortion, all of the whole sphere of abortion. There are lots of decisions which have spelled out and then narrowed a woman's right, as I see it, to make that choice herself. Those are all up for grabs, and they're very important. And the whole area of criminal law, which has already been so severely eaten away by the Rehnquist court, the current majority. Let us take as an example the right of those who are convicted in state courts and are in prison to make claims in the federal courts that they were detained, convicted, held illegally, unconstitutionally, because, let's say, they were beaten until they confessed, or they had no lawyer, or whatever. The Supreme Court, in its current guise, has greatly narrowed, virtually eliminated the right, the historic right, very old right of those people in state prisons to raise federal constitutional issues in the federal courts. That's the kind of thing that I think is now at issue. I ought to mention one other case. It's a case that was decided 5-4 against the claim of freedom, but that I think is the most important First Amendment case decided adversely to the claim of the right of free speech in many years. It was the case of Rust against Sullivan, decided last term by the Supreme Court. That was the case in which the Supreme Court held that a federal administrative official could prevent doctors from speaking their minds about medical questions if that doctor was working in a federally aided family planning clinic and the federal official said that doctors in that clinic could not mention the word abortion or even refer clients, patients, to another doctor who would discuss abortion. That case, Rust against Sullivan, was not an abortion case, really. It was a free speech case, the right of doctors to speak their minds about medical issues. I think it was a very, very important and worrying case, because what it said, in essence, is if the federal government gives an institution money, it can dictate what is said in that institution, whether it is a family planning clinic, an art gallery, a university, a scientific laboratory. I suppose all of those follow. And nowadays, so many institutions that were once wholly private in our society are aided, seek money of some kind from the federal government. And if that is going to be the rule, if Rust against Sullivan is applied generally, the federal government has a very great power to decide who can say what, a power that I think the First Amendment does not allow it to have.
Anthony Lewis, in your New York Times column, you write about just about any political or social issue that is of concern to you and to the nation. I'm wondering what some of the strains are that accompany that kind of responsibility, you know, of being informed on so many subjects, informed enough to be confident of the opinion that you're going to state.
What a good question. What a worrying question. It's a very strange position to be in as a journalist. At least on the New York Times, columnists are what you say, responsible entirely for their own views. Nobody tells us what to say. And every once in a while you say to yourself, wow, am I making a mistake? Might I have said something? And of course we all do make mistakes. I try to confess them as quickly as I can. But those are mistakes maybe on a particular facts, but mistakes of judgment, of policy, of wisdom, those are hard to correct, and they stay with you. They worry you. What do I say? I think part of the answer is that I don't write about everything. People come to me and say, won't you please write about such and such an issue in a country that concerns me greatly? If I've never been there, if I don't know about that country, I tend to say no because I hope I understand the limits of what I can comprehend. But I tend to write about certain general areas. Law is one of them. Human rights is another. I have experience in and concern about the Middle East, Southern Africa, the Soviet Union. Those tend to be my dominant subjects, maybe to an obsessive degree. So maybe that kind of self-limitation, though not universal, is wise.
As I'm sure you're aware, the conservative magazine National Review often takes you to task for opinions that you've written in the New York Times. I wonder if you subscribe to the National Review, if for no other reason, just to see what they're saying about you.
No, I don't. I have a lot of respect for the National Review and for its originator, Bill Buckley. But I guess life is too short to want to find myself knocked in the head that often. I mean, I read plenty of things that are abusive about me, and I try to grin and bear it. And mostly, if they spell my name right, I'm happy.
Well, Anthony Lewis, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
It's been my great pleasure, Terry. Thank you.
Anthony Lewis's new book is Make No Law, The Sullivan Case and the First Amendment. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.